The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm, filed for bankruptcy.
That's CBS News. 10 years ago this week, we saw the beginnings of what would become the Great Recession. By many measures, the economy has recovered, but it's also left lots of people behind. Plus, there's an exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago that celebrates the science, math, and technology skills behind Pixar.
When life gets you down, you know what you gotta do?
I don't wanna know what you gotta do.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim.
It's designed especially for kids. But first, how is your phone affecting your mental health? We're speaking with one Illinois psychologist about how technology grabs your attention and refuses to let go. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, this week marks 10 years since Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy and the financial crisis that affected all of our lives started to unfold. By some measures, the U.S. economy has recovered from the recession, but have all of us recovered? We'd love to hear how the recession has affected you. You can always give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We're going to get to that conversation in a few minutes. We'll also, in the hour, be talking about a new Pixar exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago that's pulling the curtain back on all of your favorite movies. But first, you may have heard yesterday, Apple has announced yet another round of new iPhones. Each one has been more advanced than the last, and since 2007, when the iPhone was first announced, the way we consume information has changed dramatically. It's hard to believe it's just been 10 years, but today, news, apps, social media, and social interaction are all at the tip of our fingers, and the companies that run them are worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Actually, in Apple's case, that number has reached $1 trillion. But how do our phones affect our mental health, especially given how much we use them? With me now in our Urbana studio is Alejandro Lleras. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana. He studies attention, and he's also a member of the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois. Alejandro, thank you for being with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me here.
Also joining us on the line is Lali Abril. She's an associate professor of communications at UIC Chicago. Hi, Lali. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for being here. Alejandro, can I start with you? When we think about the idea of, in 2016, Apple confirmed that users unlock their iPhones an average of 80 times a day. Maybe that doesn't seem that much, but there's other research that shows that we touch our phones as many as 2,000 times in one day. And that data is actually a few years old. So I wonder, when we're how often are we, even if we're maybe not unlocking our phones, how much are we touching it? How much is it a part of our attention?
Yeah, well, the actual number today is probably worse. I think every day and every year, we're interacting with our phones more and more. I think one thing to keep in mind is that we have very large companies like Google, but also smaller companies, maybe like the New York Times, who are constantly trying to improve the way that they connect and they call your attention. So we have lots of billions of dollars focused on capturing your attention, and they're getting better and better every day, and we have more and more pools on our attention. So we unlocked our phone and 80 times a day maybe, and if you actually count it, that comes out to like five times an hour during waking hours, and not even considering the fact that you have to work and do other things.
That's lot of time that we're spending on our phone. Yes. And then actually, it's not even just the time we're spending on our phone. You've looked at the fact that even if we're not actually on the phone, we're thinking about it.
Yes. And some of the research that we did in our lab looked at trying to understand the interactions with either the internet or your smartphone from an addiction angle, right? So if we take questions that we usually ask cigarette addicts or gambling addicts or alcohol addicts, you know, how much does doing this behavior interfere with your work? How much do you prefer doing this behavior to hanging out with friends, right? Then we can do that. with the focus on interacting with a phone. And we found that when you do that, there's a very large correlation between how people score in those kind of questionnaires and how they score in depression and anxiety questionnaires, which is kind of troubling.
Mm. So you're saying there's a correlation, it sounds like,
yes,
between what we see as traditional behaviors that can cause addictions to the way that we actually use our phones?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. So the idea is, you know, if you start using the phone, or someone you know start using your phone to avoid certain problems in their life, or when they're sad, they turn to their phone, or when they're anxious, they turn to their phones. And to the extent that it starts, you know, interfering with their daily activities, then you start seeing something that looks like an addictive behavior. And I think more and more of us feel like we are maybe becoming addicted to our phones, right?
Mm. That's Alejandro Lleras, who's a psychologist at the University of Illinois, as well as with the Beckman Institute here at the U of I. Lali Abril is also with us from UIC. Lali, when we think about this, is what Alejandro is talking about, how hard is it for people to separate themselves from, as he's talking about, the negative impacts of technology when it's so ever-present, when it's always surrounding us?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That's looking a little bit at the dark side of media and technology, which is very real, and it's worsening, it seems. However, my research, I focus on the bright side of technology. So I study how we can use media and technology to foster desirable political and health outcomes. For instance, in the political realm, increased civic and political participation and voter turnout. And in the health realm, for instance, how to exercise more and achieve healthier eating habits. So I'm not denying this dark side, absolutely not. However, what I focus on in my research is more on this more bright side of media and technology. And so it's a little difficult for me to answer the question you just posed.
And so when you think about how we can use technology to better our health, as you mentioned, that's part of your research. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. I have looked, for instance, on how mobile technologies can help us track exercise much better than paper and pencil or relying on memory. A research that I published recently show a correlation between the number of times that one tracks their exercise, and that is much higher in those who track their exercise via mobile technologies. And I'm very sure that this would be even higher if we were to include fitness trackers, which at that time were not part of the study. So that's one side. Another side is to spread a social campaign and see how people discuss this campaign and make sense of the campaign. For instance, some research that I did together with some colleagues at NORC show that the tips from former smokers, we looked at how Twitter account holders discuss the ads during the months in which the campaign was going. And we saw that people were responding positively to the ads. That is, they were being fearful of smoking, and they were showing that they would be inclined to either quit or not engage in that behavior. So these are some, you know, two examples of how we can use technology to foster better health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And to that point, Alejandro, as Lali is talking about using the smoking example, I wonder when we think about, I think part of the reason why it can be a good thing as well as a bad thing is because it is so ubiquitous. And I wonder if you can explain to us a little bit about how you feel like engineers are designing these systems specifically to have our attention captured. Can you give us an example of how Facebook does this?
Yes. So, for example, let's say you post an article or a picture of yourself or something that you know and you expect is going to get a big reaction from the people who are closely follow you or your friends or your family. You post it at a time that you expect people will be able to see it. Well, a lot of people have the intuition that if their friends are online at the moment, the post that they just put will appear immediately on
their friends' timelines.
On their friends' timelines, right? And that if their friends respond, the second it responds, you're going to get a notification that says, oh, your friend Abby just responded to you. But in fact, this is not how Facebook works. So what Facebook does is that they manipulate the time between delivery of the feedback they give to you, right? So even if you're looking at your timeline, you won't see those things coming one click at a time, one heart at a time, or one smiley face at a time. They'll deliver to you after some amount of time, look, three people responded to this, or look, 10 people responded to this. And what happens is that this is similar to the way slot machines work in a way. So when you go to play a slot machine, you put your coins and you are always waiting for all the money to come out of the machine. But you
right,
never
you're
know.
Waiting for them to all line up, right? But,
and you play and you play and play. And at some point, sometimes it happens soon. Sometimes it takes longer. That's called variable reinforcement schedule, which we've known for a long time. In psychology, it is the strongest way to get people to learn and reinforce our behaviors. The strongest way is the best way to keep you just like at
this
thing.
Why is that? Because you just because you don't know what's going to happen,
yeah.
So it has your attention?
Exactly. It keeps your attention. You keep testing. Oh, maybe this is the time it's going to work. And you keep looking, you keep looking. So going back to Facebook, you put the post and just like you wait like, okay, I'll wait 5 minutes. That'll be enough. Then you go and check. And even if other people have responded, Facebook is not going to show it to you. So you're going to be like, oh, but that's so weird. But it got you to interact with it. You looked at Facebook. You looked at other posts in the meantime, and then you put it away. And then you like a couple of minutes later, you're like, oh, I wonder if this time. No, it's like, again, getting a handle on that slot machine and trying to see if now you got all the coins. And you check and like, oh, not this time. And all of a sudden you check and there's like three hearts and you're like, oh, wow, that's exactly what I was expecting. I'm so happy. You know, you get that.
And in the
jolt.
Meantime, you've checked Facebook, what, like five times?
Exactly. So that's
right.
What they're doing. They're manipulating the delivery of the feedback to you in this specific ways to get you most addicted, in a way, to their app.
But Alejandro, to that point, earlier this month, Facebook and Instagram have announced tools for users to set limits on their platforms, as well as a dashboard to monitor your daily use. How would you explain these new tools that social media companies are using? Why do you think they're implementing this at the same time?
Well, I think it's the same way that cigarette companies ended up advertising that smoking is not good. I mean, there started to be a backlash in society of people realizing that maybe it's not good the amount of time that we are spending on these devices, that our kids are spending these devices. So this is, I think, a part of a public relations campaign to try to improve their brand, all the while knowing that in the back they have hundreds of engineers and millions of dollars research going into capturing your attention more and more.
That's Alejandro Lleras. Lali Abril is with us as well. Lali, to that point that Alejandro has been making, I wonder how you think we can mitigate some of the negative effects while still getting the positive ones that you research. Where do you think the balance is?
Well, this is also a matter of content. So what kind of content people use in their phones and technology. So it is clearly not the same to spend the entire time on Facebook versus using it for interpersonal communication. So communicating with maybe for work, with your colleagues that are, not in the same locality, or communicating it for family matters, or FaceTiming with friends that are far away. These are all very different activities that we can do or that we can play with technology that have different effects. And so one of the first things that we do in communication is always very clearly talk about what is the content, what is the nature of the use that we're doing with the technology. And so, well, yes, one very clear outcome is always like, oh, you know, don't do it too much. But always this falls back to the individual. And the individuals can do, you know, so much. For instance, some of the work that I do, I look at food environments and how we're surround, you know, what surrounds us, in either in terms of our physical environment, but also our social media environment. If I get a lot of pictures of delicious foods on Instagram all the time, you know, how does that affect me? It's the same idea that if you're thinking that you're trying to, you know, to get a healthier diet and you go and live in a hotel where there's only junk food and sweet desserts all over, you know, all over the place, it's going to be much more difficult to have healthy choices, because a choice set would be completely different from one in which you go to a hotel in which there is healthy foods all over. There's a salad bar, there's veggies, there's lean protein. So that's two very different environments. The individual is the same, but the environment in which you're setting that individual determines to a very high degree how much, you know, the choices that this individual is going to make. And so what things we can do? We can do so much, you know, as an individual. For instance, what do I do? Well, I try to be a role model for my kids. I try not to be on my phone all the time when I'm with them. I very deliberately set limits on technology for our kids.
Not just for your kids, but for yourself, right, Lali? And I'm afraid to stop you there, but we're out of time. But it sounds like the lesson that you're saying is that obviously we can take better control of this and self-regulate as well. I want to thank Lali Abril for being with us. Thank you. She's a professor at UIC. Alejandro Lleras is at U of I and the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois as a professor of psychology. Alejandro, Lali, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Support for the 21st comes from the University of Illinois Press, publishers of An Illini Place, Building the University of Illinois Campus, documenting the grand plans and intimate stories behind the creation of a classic American campus. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. $61,372. That was the median income of the American household last year, according to a census report released yesterday. Why is that significant? Well, because it's at the same level that American households were earning 1 year before the financial crisis and recession that started in 2008. So at least by that measure, the economy has recovered from the financial crisis and recession. Of course, though, we know it's not that simple. We know the recovery has felt different depending on what you look like, how much you make, where you live. What do you remember from that time? And are you still feeling the effects of the Great Recession? You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. With us now to talk about this are three guests from all across Illinois. Matt Towidigdo is an associate professor of economics at Northwestern University. Larry Holin is a managing broker with Pioneer Real Estate in Rockford. And on the line from Charleston, Michael Gillespie is an assistant professor of sociology at Eastern Illinois University. Gentlemen, thanks for being here with me this morning on the 21st.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Nyla.
Matt, I wonder if we can start with you. In 2008, I was the economy reporter for the Miami Herald, so I very well remember the weekend of Lehman Brothers collapsing. It was like this, I felt like it was sort of this incredible cascade of horrific financial news. I wonder if you can take us back to that time. What did the economy look like shortly before that bankruptcy? What were the warning signs? Were there any?
It's a great question. It was a memorable time to me, too. I actually worked at Lehman Brothers 4 years before that, and I had very good timing. I left to go to graduate school a couple years before then. I think what's important to keep in mind is that the fall of Lehman Brothers, which was, you know, a very surprising event, actually was several months after the housing market had already started to turn. You know, you probably all remember that several years before that, housing was just going crazy. There was a big housing bubble in many areas of the country. And when that started to turn, then Lehman Brothers and many other banks found themselves in pretty tough position. So what was going on here was really the start of what turned out to be a very long-lasting recession that now economists, we call the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm. And Larry, to Matt's point about real estate, what do you remember from those first days and months of, I guess this would be late 2007, 2008, from your standpoint as a real estate broker in Rockford?
So, Nyla, I also remember that very well. We were doing a large amount of new construction at the time. In fact, many builders couldn't build houses fast enough, and they were putting specs up that would start at one price, and by the time the house was framed and enclosed, the price had already gone up 5, 6, 7, sometimes 10%. But what was interesting is, and I go back to one transaction where we were selling a house to a local judge, and that judge was seeking financing from a lender, and I got a call one day that said, that lender's out of business, and we can't close. And it just struck me as kind of interesting that, you know, I've got a great buyer, great credit, great profession, and the lender just went out of business. Just like that, poof, they were gone. So that was the beginning of it for us, and we saw that escalate quickly into lenders going out of business. People couldn't get financing. It was really quite terrible, and it was terrible very quickly.
And Larry, just the whole notion that a bank who was financing a mortgage wouldn't exist, that was almost prior to 2007, at least in modern American history. We just thought, oh, that can't happen, right? Did you think
that? Exactly. In fact, we were seeing lenders crop up out of nowhere, not disappear. So we were seeing new lenders all the time, people coming into the industry that were not banking professionals or didn't have a history of that type of work, all of a sudden were mortgage lenders. And for one to go out of business, it was very startling.
And Matt, of course, now all of the details of this, I think most of our audience well remembers all of the subprime mortgages and loans and lending. But I wonder at that moment, what it really was like to have this sort of cascade of events. And I wonder if you can just sort of describe how unusual that was first for us.
Well, what was unusual was exactly what Larry said, how fast all of this happened. Unemployment surged incredibly quickly around the same time. The share of people who were unemployed for a very long time went up very drastically. So my expertise is actually in labor economics, and I was really motivated by this to study a lot of policies that we had towards long-term unemployed, policies we had towards unemployment insurance, for example. So, something Obama did as an emergency measure was extended unemployment insurance benefits from their usual 26 weeks to 99 weeks, which you probably remember seeing in the news, that it was so hard to find jobs during this time period that unemployed workers were able to collect UI benefits for as many as 99 weeks just because it was so hard to find work during that time period.
Yeah, that's right. A reminder, they had that emergency extension. That's Matt Notowi-Digdo. He's an associate professor of economics at Northwestern University. On the line from Charleston and Eastern Illinois University is Michael Gillespie. Michael, you study hunger and poverty, particularly in rural areas. And I wonder what effect we saw with the financial crisis, especially in smaller towns across Illinois.
In smaller towns across Illinois and really rural areas across the country, the effects were acute because so many services, so many resources for the larger society were starting to be taxed with all the social insurances and things. But when you start off at a place where those services are much more spread out and are much more smaller in number, there is automatically becomes fewer resources because more people are automatically going to need them. So while a lot of the storylines that we saw in the big cities and in suburban areas sort of got the headlines, there was a more acute effect in rural areas because what little there was available got spread out to more and more people. So it became a much thinner social safety net. In rural areas.
And as we talk about the recovery, Michael, I wonder also, as we sort of delve into how uneven that has been, one of the things I said at the beginning was we know the recoveries felt different depending on where you live. How long do you think, like when you hear that the median household income of the American household last year is back up to basically statistically insignificant from what it was in 2007, that's just a number. What can you tell us about what the reality is for a lot of people, particularly when I'm thinking about, for example, the Charleston area?
That's right. That number is for the whole United States. And so that number differs depending on where you're at. I know here in Coles County and in the Charleston area, our median household income is about $35,000. And so that falls well below that national average. I know the median income for Illinois as a state is just a little bit higher than that. So in areas like Charleston and Coles County, where there's very little booming industry, most of the jobs are service sector, and most of them require very little training and oftentimes skills involved, the income lacks well far behind. And so that translates then into all the different opportunities and how you build the commerce within a community, the types of businesses that are willing to come in. It affects the housing economy, and it spreads out throughout the entire system.
Matt, as Michael is talking about what that number looks like, for example, in Coles County where he is, I wonder, you mentioned before your interest in the labor market. As we see this household income number, I wonder what our income growth looks like. How much is that measuring up compared to how it's been over the past couple of years?
Sure. I think that the statistic is one indicator that maybe suggests we're returning to normal, but economists tend to look at other indicators as well besides just median income. I think some of the other key statistics you want to focus on are the overall unemployment rate, and also I think the overall labor force participation rate, just what share of people are in the labor market, that actually hasn't gone back to where it has before the onset of the Great Recession. So if you just look at prime age adults, men and women, regardless of level of education, and ask what share of them are working, that's still lower than it was before. And in fact, employment overall has been sagging since really the start of the new century, the early 2000s. So I think this presents kind of a mixed picture about the recovery, is that on some dimensions, like unemployment, which has now been hovering around 4%, or median income, which is now back to where it was before, there are other measures that suggest that there's still a little bit of slack in the economy and there's still room for more recovery.
And Larry, as we think about how this relates to real estate, you were on previously a couple months ago actually talking about the foreclosure rate, particularly in your part of the state in Rockford. So much of that is correlated to jobs and the labor market. What are you seeing now when it comes to, certainly things are not, I'm sure you would say we've turned a corner, but where are we in terms of the housing market? And I'm thinking particularly on the foreclosure side first, that end of the market that really was sort of the delinquency side of the market. What is that looking like right now?
So the foreclosure market in our part of the state has improved dramatically from where it was in 2013, which was kind of the height of the foreclosure market. That at that time, foreclosures represented nearly half of all sales of real estate, residential real estate. That number now is down to around 5%. And that can be attributed a couple ways. One, I look at the total number of foreclosures, and they're down quite a bit. But because values have started to increase in our area again, sellers are willing to put their houses on the market, take the risk of buying another house, and we're seeing home sales go up. And in fact, we've seen the home sale prices now, the home sale prices now are about equivalent to where they were in 2007.
So I know that when the last time you were on, it was because one of the things we were talking about, there were a couple, it sounds like you're in your real estate office while we're talking. I'm glad the phone's ringing. That's a good sign that it's busy, right?
Right.
I understand that Rockford is still among a couple Illinois communities that were in the top 10 in the U.S. in the number of foreclosures. Would you say that's one portion of the market? Overall, do you think the housing market has bounced back in Rockford?
Indeed. We took a couple important measures a few years ago. The real estate community, in conjunction with the city of Rockford and a couple other, the school district, park district, et cetera, where we actually incentivized buyers to not only acquire foreclosed properties, but to build new homes in the city of Rockford. And the program was essentially, if you were to buy a foreclosure or build new construction, your property taxes would be waived for 3 years. So that was a great incentive to, absorb the foreclosure inventory, but also encourage new construction in our market. So we're seeing much better numbers in terms of what people are willing to do that were not willing to do in 2013. In other words, they're willing to put their house in the market, they've built equity, they see some equity in the house, and they're willing to move on now to their next house.
That's Larry Holin with Pioneer Real Estate in Rockford. Matt, I wonder if I can ask you, as Larry's talking about these programs that they did in the Rockford area, when we look across the country, do you feel like we have addressed some of the root causes of this financial crisis when we're thinking particularly about the housing market and subprime loans? Do you think we have addressed some of these problems in a way that they will not come back again?
That's a great question. I think that there's probably arguments you can make in support of that. The kinds of mortgages you saw in the eve of the housing crisis are not mortgages you see as much anymore. And I think partly that comes from regulation. So I think some of the riskiest types of securities you're not seeing, and those securities probably contributed to the risk that led to the crisis in the first place. That's not to say that we're never going to have another housing bubble. I think bubbles are going to be with us forever. We just have to do our best to try to spot them.
Michael, what do you think when we're thinking particularly about rural areas or lower income folks? How many of those people do you think are able to get back into the housing market?
I think the housing market in rural areas before the recession, during it, and after lags far behind some of the more metropolitan suburban areas. The population outpouring from rural areas isn't helping at all either. It's not like people are looking to gentrify a farmland. People are trying to get to where industries are growing, where jobs are at, where opportunities are, and oftentimes those are not in rural areas. And so that's just going to depress the market even more as people move out seeking better opportunities elsewhere.
And Matt, as we're talking about the discrepancies between rural and urban, I also wanted to ask you about how it is depending on income level when we're talking about class and also race. What does that look like?
Yeah, I think that's important to keep in mind, too. It's not just where you're living, but what your background is. I think that something that labor economists like myself have been focusing on are people's educational backgrounds, because you see rising income stratification by levels of education. That's true in Illinois, and it's true all over the country. If you want to understand how well people have recovered during the Great Recession, the level of education is one of the key pieces that seems to have helped people recover better. So I think that's definitely important to keep in mind. As far as race, it's a little bit further from my expertise, but during the recession, a lot of race gaps grew quite significantly if you're comparing blacks to whites, for example, and those have started to gradually recover as the economy's recovered.
Right. And I know we're seeing Hispanic income, white income going up, African American income still going down. Matt, just a quick question about education. Is the differential high school or college degrees?
It's really, you see it across almost any pair of education. More education seems to protect you better during downturns. But I think one of the key separating points seems to be having some college education versus no college education at all, as well as having a four-year college degree versus something less than that. So I think that's where policymakers tend to put a lot of their attention when they're thinking about policies to encourage people to sort of make that next step to invest more in their education. They're looking at getting people into college, into community colleges.
Yeah, that makes
hopefully
sense.
Graduating with a four-year degree.
Matt, we're going to have to take a break. If you can stick around, I just wanted to ask you all one more question after the break, if everyone can stay tuned to the 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a performance by the Karu Na Trio, bringing their rhythm and sonic languages to Spurlock Museum on Sunday, September 16th at 2 p.m. This event is part of the Improvisers Exchange Initiative. More information at cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the lingering effects of the Great Recession, which started more than 10 years ago, actually. Michael Gillespie's with us. He's an associate professor of sociology at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. On the line from Chicago, from the Evanston area, is Matt Natowidigdo. He's an associate professor of economics at Northwestern University. Michael, I wanted to ask you and Matt about one last question about healthcare. And I think there's obviously a lot we could talk about as we're talking about the last 10 years of the American economy. But I wanted to focus specifically on healthcare for low-income families, because I think one of the big changes we've seen between 2007 and 2017 was the Affordable Care Act. And within that, some states, including Illinois, deciding to expand their Medicaid coverage. How do you think that decision affected families recovering from the recession?
I think it in part provided an extra lifeline in terms of getting access to services, especially with expansions in the state. People who live in rural areas, who predominantly poor rural areas, lean on public insurance programs, whether it's healthcare or other social insurance programs, much more heavily than people who live in other parts of the state and other sectors of society, metropolitan and suburban areas. And so any bolstering to that social safety net through healthcare, through social services, is always going to be a benefit. The question then becomes, you know, how easily accessible are they? How far away do people live from providers who will accept such benefits, and so on and so forth? That's a whole nother issue. But the access to them and getting them by any stretch does help people who need it the most.
And Matt, now that there are questions about that access and the very act of the Affordable Care Act, I wonder what kind of economic impact you think that might have.
Well, let me first just agree with what Michael said, that I think the main clear impact we've seen of the Affordable Care Act is on access to healthcare. And we've learned this by being able to compare the states that did expand versus the states that did not expand. You have big increases in health insurance coverage, reductions in the number of uninsured, and you have more utilization, more people visiting the hospital, more people going to the emergency department, more people going to primary care physicians. So that increased access, I think, is the main thing to focus on. There can be additional economic effects of this that could affect, you know, the need. Hospitals might need to hire more people. So it could affect the demand for labor in those sectors. And that's sort of where the research is still being worked on right now. But I think the main thing that we've seen, and that's, I think, pretty intuitive, is just more people have been able to get access to health care as a result of the ACA.
And how does that change people's economic situations, I wonder, Matt?
Well, one thing I teach in my health economics class is that one of the main things health insurance does, it's a little bit misleading in the way it's labeled. It doesn't insure your health. It actually insures you financially. So what access to public health insurance does is it prevents you from accumulating a lot of medical debt. It protects you from having to face a lot of bills when you go to the hospital unexpectedly. Health insurance has a lot of financial protection. And I think in all of the states that expanded the ACA, you saw many low-income households who would otherwise have been uninsured benefiting financially from that policy.
There's so much more that we could talk about, but we'll just leave it at that. That's Matt Natowidigdo. He's an associate professor of economics at Northwestern University. I want to thank Michael Gillespie, who teaches in sociology at Eastern Illinois University, and Larry Holand for being with us from Rockford, where he is the managing broker at Pioneer Real Estate. Larry, Michael, Matt, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Buzz Lightyear to Star Command. Come in, Star Command.
I'm watching you, Wazowski. Always watching.
Whew, she's nuts.
Honey!
What?
Where's my super suit?
What?
Where is my super suit?
Canada, firstborn descendant of Clan Dunbroch, and I'll be shooting for my own hand.
When life gets you down, you know what you gotta do?
I don't wanna know what you gotta do.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim, swim.
Dorino singing.
Those are a few of our favorite Pixar movie scenes, from the very first Toy Story in 1995 all the way to Brave in 2012. When we talk about Pixar, we say the magic of it because the creativity and emotions in these movies touch all of us, regardless of our age. But besides magic, maybe alchemy is a better word, because it's creativity combined with technology and science that brings these computer-generated animations to life. And showcasing all of the science, technology, engineering, and math skills involved in CGA are what's behind a Museum of Science and Industry exhibit in Chicago called The Science Behind Pixar. On the line with us now from Chicago is Jeff Bonomo. He's a senior manager of special exhibitions at the museum. A note to our audience, by the way, all this month, admission to the museum is free on Sundays. Although we understand tickets for the Pixar exhibition are sold out for those days, this is an exhibit that's on until January 9th. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So I had a chance to go through the Pixar exhibition a few weeks ago. It's really remarkable, I think, first, just how big this exhibit is, as well as the evolution of technology. And maybe that's why, Jeff, this is such a big exhibit?
Yeah, it's one of our largest temporary exhibitions that we've ever held. It's in two galleries. And as you got to experience, there's a lots to do in there. And you really learn how complex the kind of behind-the-scenes processes of bringing the magic to the screen is.
Yeah, I had budgeted an hour. That was not enough time for our Pixar exhibition journey that we went on. As I mentioned, Jeff, the technology has really evolved with each film, from learning how to make the toys move in Toy Story to how Merida's hair in Brave was curly. Jeff, why is that? When I think this is one of the interesting things about the exhibit is, why is something like a computer animated character having curly hair a technological challenge?
I think, as you learned in the exhibit, every little nuance in every film has a lot of time and talent that goes into it. And the more complex each film is, for example, creating the hair move like a spring makes the rendering, which is when they do the final stages of putting the film into a file that can actually be seen on the screen, take so long. So it really is a labor of love, and fascinating to see how much time and effort goes into the process of just making Miranda's hair move so it looks natural.
Jeff, what kind of response are you getting from schools and kids who are visiting the exhibit?
Schools, groups, kids, everyone loves it. There's something even for the littlest kids to do, because there's some large characters of your favorite film friends come to life. But it's really geared towards middle school kids that are interested or may soon be interested in kind of some of those STEM careers, and not realizing that some of this math they're learning and science and everything that they're learning in their day-to-day school day is what goes into these films.
That's Jeff Bonomo with the Museum of Science and Industry on the line from Chicago. In studio here with me in Urbana is Keith Jacobs. He's a STEM education specialist with the State 4-H office, speaking of middle schoolers. Hey, Keith, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
Keith, when we think about particularly middle schoolers, they really have like a couple generations of people growing up with Pixar movies,
certainly.
Right? So when I wonder how much an entry pop culture thing like Pixar movies is to bring kids into the world of STEM education.
Oh, man, it's huge. You know, most youth don't realize the connection between STEM and something like a Pixar film. They don't realize that a lot of the technology that's behind those films, they have in their own hand, and things like cell phones, you know, like AR, emojis, stuff like that, augmented reality. They may know how to use the end product, but oftentimes they don't see the connection between the stuff they're doing, just like Jeff said, the stuff they're doing in school with their STEM programs or whatever STEM education they're getting, and the career path that leads to that. And connecting those dots is something that's really important, especially at that age.
Right. And so I went through this exhibit with two young, a preteen and a teenager, and I thought it was really interesting how they were very excited about coding. And it was really hard. I mean, just to plot a point, to figure out one little movement, I was just like, this is a lot of work. Keith, how important is it, do you think, to engage students in something like this outside of a classroom setting?
Oh, man, that's really, I believe in hooking youth. And if you could find a hook, this is a really good hook to get them involved in that type of stuff. And once they're hooked, then you open the doors for endless possibilities. And you actually allow the youth to be able to see that there is a path. And, hey, I could actually do this in the future. And this stuff that's you call science and technology isn't that, like, boring. There's actually cool STEM career paths. So I think all of them are cool. But
Jeff, I wonder, when we think about an example of that in the exhibit, is there something that comes to mind for you? I'm thinking about one of the interactive exhibits is even just how to make a school of fish move and how hard that was to figure out how to do that naturally and the programming that's involved with that for Nemo, for the Nemo films.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite interactives in the exhibition is being able to move Jessie's eyebrows and just all the work that goes into making her expression change by just changing her eyebrows and how much intense labor goes into that.
Right. I wonder, Jeff, as you said it was for all ages, have you gotten any concern from parents who might feel like this is pulling back the curtain a little bit too much, like maybe taking away some of the mystery of Pixar movies for our youngest audience members?
We haven't had any complaints about that. I think to your earlier points, it's just great to show how much goes on behind the curtain and how much is math-based and science-based. Because you sit back, relax, and you enjoy an hour-and-a-half film, but just to now appreciate everything that goes into it. And now kids might say, hey, this math that I'm doing in school is important, and maybe I can still be in the film business and learn math and apply it to that.
Keith, I think this is an example of how there's probably a lot of science, technology, engineering in our everyday lives that we don't think about.
Absolutely.
And you probably see this everywhere.
Oh, yeah, man, all the time. And like I said, phones, that's really, for this generation, our generation, phones are one of the most advanced pieces of technology that we have in our environment, but we only use them for specific things, you know, to call people, text, you know, maybe get on social media and whatnot. But I show kids, like, for example, virtual reality. They don't realize that with a couple of little lenses and, like, a piece of cardboard, they can transform their phone into a completely, like, 100% immersive virtual reality environment for little to nothing.
And do you think kids realize, I think actually maybe younger kids who are playing augmented reality games have a better sense of this than, or anyone who's playing an augmented reality game. Can you explain what that is for people?
So basically augmented reality is taking something in that's digital, like on a screen, and being able to place it in your real world. So an example would be like the Pokemon Go games, stuff like that, where you're actually trying to find things that exist in your real environment, but they exist in the phone. As well.
And Keith, what does the research show about what age we really want to get? If we want to grow the next generation of engineers and
Absolutely.
STEM people within this country, what age are we supposed to be really
grabbing at? So we're looking at middle school. There are a few transitional years and transitional periods. Middle school, by far, is definitely where we want to be hooking these youth. That's where we see most of our youth engaging in this type of activity or activities like this that lead to career paths in STEM. And not just middle school, but going all the way up the gamut through high school. But the younger we can get them and actually get them involved, as long as they're solidified and around that age group, they're going to be thinking at least about those type of careers.
That's Keith Jacobs. He's a STEM education specialist with the State 4-H office. He's based here at the University of Illinois in the Extension office. Jeff, how long is this exhibit going on at the Museum of Science and Industry? I know the free tickets for the rest of Sundays for this month are gone, but where can people go to learn some more information?
Sure. Everything is at msichicago.org. And as you mentioned, we have Sunday free days in September, but we also have some free days for Illinois residents Monday through Wednesday in September, where you can also get Pixar tickets during that time. But the exhibition will be here through the end of the year with our popular holiday exhibition, Christmas Around the World, and it'll close January 6th.
Oh, so that's a good reminder. So Illinois residents are all free during the month of Monday through Friday in the month of September?
Monday through Wednesday. Yep.
Okay, that's great to know, too. Thanks for being with us. It's Jeff Bonomo. He's a senior manager of special exhibitions and business partnerships for the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. Jeff, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today and for this week. By the way, speaking of technology, if you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find our past programs there. It's a pretty simple app to download. Then you set your home station, whatever your local NPR station is. And if you search for The 21st to follow us, that's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background. You can also search for us on Facebook to like us, send us messages, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.